At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
You want a report? We got a report. We got a housing report. We got a finance report. We got a catfish report on the program today as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 19th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, fine. It was, by and large, a political week in the news in this country. But once again, and for the record, A, this is a global economy, and B, one neglects economic news at one's peril. So with that, 5, maybe 6 minutes now on the past 5 days in business and this economy. Gina Smilek, late of Bloomberg, soon to be in a couple of weeks, the Federal Reserve reporter for the New York Times. Dion Rabone is the markets editor at Axios. Hello to you both.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Dion, let me start with you and the global economy, as it were. I want to talk about China, the news we got this week that growth there was actually up a little bit. I actually saw the phrase green shoots about the Chinese economy. Mm. Could we perhaps be turning a corner on the much rumored but never yet arrived global recession and slowdown?
Ooh, yeah, that's a good question. A good way to frame that.
I know.
We could be, but here's the thing. I don't know. And China was always the big deal, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah. You look out at the world and you got to take a global view. As you said, Europe is still slowing. Japan is still slowing. They've said they're going to go ahead and do this raise to 10% sales tax in the fourth quarter. And people are expecting them to potentially fall into recession. You could have Germany in recession, Italy in recession, the UK in recession. Those are some big issues. And the thing with China is they're pushing the stimulus. The whole idea was they were supposed to be pulling back stimulus, unlevering or delevering their economy, and they're actually doing just the opposite. They were doing that for a reason because they're on an unsustainable debt path. So yes, definitely this is good news, the data we've seen out of China. Also, I think it is interesting that in a while, I think over the past 6-7 months, I haven't heard anyone question the data out of China as they were for years and years before that.
True.
It seems like investors have really just kind of forgotten all about that.
All right, Gina Smilek, bring it back home because retail sales were up this week in the American economy. The American consumer is still buying. Could we perhaps be leading the way in avoiding a global slowdown?
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting question. And again, I think it's one that you've just got to take with a grain of salt. If you look at a bar chart of retail sales over the last 6 months, they have just been gyrating wildly. You know, it's down, it's up, it's down again. And so I think it's really hard to take a really significant reading from retail sales just because we've seen a lot of payback from that really weak December number. And we were kind of waiting for that. So it's hard to take too much of a nod from that. I think the good news story on the U.S. economy might be that the labor market is still chugging along. You know, we saw some signs of slowdown. That seems to have abated at this point. And so I think if you continue to see solid wage gains, if you continue to see really low initial jobless claims and unemployment, you could see a pretty positive consumer story.
And interestingly, Dion, this week there were record low first-time claims for unemployment and continuing claims for unemployment benefits were down as well.
Yeah, and the 4-week trend was at its lowest since I think it was November of 1969, which I thought was really interesting. Wrote about that in the Axios Markets newsletter. Actually, what was really interesting is there was a lot, I got a good deal of blowback from that with people saying, hey, you know, this metric isn't representative of what's going on in the real economy. I put out a story earlier in the week about how the gig economy is distorting some of these numbers. The Dallas Fed actually put out a paper saying that the gig economy has a lot of people who are working gigs or who are between jobs, but who still report themselves as employed. And that's actually sort of reducing not just the number of people who are reported unemployed, but the people who file for these kind of benefits. And that's pushing the number down below where it historically has been.
Yeah, Gina, can we get away from the headline numbers for a minute here? And I'm going to get all anecdotal on you. Inflation in this economy, once again, not really a huge issue, according to the headline numbers out this week. But if you go out there, gas, I mean, you know, here in California, we run expensive on gas anyway, but I'm paying $4.09 for a gallon of gas. So, tell me about it. So, so the consumers are feeling things that maybe are not, Gina, showing up in the numbers?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point. I think one thing that is worth keeping in mind is that those sort of those fuel gauges, food and fuel, they are a bit noisy. That's why the Fed doesn't pay a ton of attention to them when it's thinking about monetary policy. But of course, consumers do feel them, which is why you can't ignore them entirely. But I think what really matters is whether those pump prices you're seeing now, whether those are sustained or whether those come down later in the year. And I think we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. I want to do two things about the Federal Reserve. Number one, Robert Kaplan, the president of the Dallas Fed, said this week, you know what, no matter what growth numbers do in this economy, I don't think the Fed's going to change its stance on interest rates, which is, as we know right now, to just sort of take it easy and sit for a minute. And Dan, I want to know what you say about that, just in terms of the cost of money in this economy.
Yeah, it makes sense, though, because I think the real change that was made was the Fed really stepped back and said, you know what, inflation's not going up. We don't need to keep raising rates. And if you can keep inflation at bay, which is one half of the Fed's mandate, and unemployment isn't ticking up, which is the other half, then there's no reason for them to move forward and make these moves. So I completely understand what he was saying.
All right. Fair enough. Gina, I'm going to turn to you and ask you the political question about the economy this week. The markets and generally speaking, everybody who's not a political reporter looked at the Mueller report and kind of went, yeah, you know, the economy's strong. We're good. Did that surprise you at all?
You know, I think that that's what a lot of economists were expecting going into the Mueller report. I think people just kind of thought that we basically knew what we were going to know, and markets just weren't anticipating a lot of news out of that. And I don't think that they saw anything that surprised them in a significant way.
And companies are still making money, right, Dion? So be it, right?
So be it, yeah. So and you look at what's the worst possible outcome, which is Trump gets impeached, which is highly unlikely. Right. Then you got President Pence, and he's good for the markets too. So I don't really know if there was a lot to take from this.
Dion Rabowan at Axios and Gina Smilek, soon to be of the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks
for having me.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, things were actually pretty quiet. Markets were closed for Good Friday. There was trading elsewhere, though, so we will have some details when we do the numbers. It was bank robbery, about which the phrase, that's where the money is, was most memorably used. But it applies equally as a reason so many non-financial companies are getting into financial services. Google Pay, Amazon Cash, Apple Pay, now T-Mobile. This week, the wireless company rolled out something called T-Mobile Money Nationwide, basically a digital mobile checking account. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams checked out the business case.
T-Mobile likes to call itself the Uncarrier to distinguish itself from its much bigger rivals, Verizon and AT&T. This new digital wallet is yet another effort to do that, says Amy Zirkel at the Electronic Transactions Association, a financial industry trade group of which T-Mobile is a member.
I'm sure it's about a value add and extending the reach of its brand. So I think there is a piece there of just demonstrating that they're not just a phone company.
You don't need to be a T-Mobile customer to use T-Mobile Money, but you get more perks if you are. There's no minimum balance, up to a 4% interest rate, and fewer fees than many banks. T-Mobile is hoping that will draw in lower-income customers, the so-called underbanked. But there's a risk.
Not having a bank branch that you can walk into to deal with real people can be an issue.
Lauren Saunders is with the National Consumer Law Center.
And if you're relying on your smartphone to access your financial account, that may not always work for people who can't always afford the phone bill, have intermittent internet access.
But for those who do have access, there's another reason for T-Mobile to get into this space, says Christopher Cole with the Independent Community Bankers of America.
It's obviously done to counter Apple Pay and what Apple is doing in for their phone systems.
And Cole says it could also end up forcing AT&T and Verizon to follow T-Mobile's lead. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
While a whole lot of macroeconomic indicators have been looking pretty good, here are a couple that aren't looking so good. New government data out today showed home building last month fell to a nearly two-year low. Both building permits, that is, permits to build, and housing starts, breaking ground, construction, they were both down. And as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports, this is not most likely going to be just a one-month blip.
Part of the problem? It's more expensive for builders to build. The costs of land and labor are up. Zillow housing economist Skylar Olson says the price of construction supplies is also increasing.
Whether it's because of kind of some trade protections that have been newly put in place that has changed the price of, say, lumber, but also just the price of other components.
Like siding and drywall, soaring costs are driving construction companies to build more expensive homes. They're also building fewer homes overall. There's not enough supply to meet demand, which pushes prices up. Tendai Kapfidze is chief economist at LendingTree, which just surveyed millennial home buyers.
Two-thirds of first-time buyers complain that, you know, there's not enough affordable homes.
It's a vicious cycle. Developers don't build housing in the lower price range, causing shortages and pushing up prices. In econo-speak,
we're trapped in a kind of a supply-side, demand-side challenge.
That's economist Robert Dietz of the National Association of Home Builders. Dietz has a few ideas, building houses closer together and farther from city centers. And more home buyers could just go where it's cheaper.
We've seen over the last couple of years population movement from the West Coast out to markets in Utah, Colorado, Idaho, and Montana to achieve home ownership.
Even with that movement, Dietz expects the housing slump to drag on for the next few years. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The British Parliament, much like the American Congress, is on its Easter recess, which means Britain's long-running agony over Brexit is on the back burner for a week or so. It's a welcome respite for the Brits, I'm sure, but comedians across the European Union know a good source of material when they see it, especially in Germany, where television shows have regularly been having a good laugh at the whole thing. But a handful of leading German economists say the UK is not alone in bearing responsibility for that fiasco. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on it.
Order!
Britain's parliamentary pantomime has caused endless merriment in Germany, where TV shows pour scorn on bumbling, bungling British politicians.
Boris Johnson, ex-außenminister und völlig durchgeknallter Brexit-Hardliner. Yeah.
This satirical show's had great fun taunting the UK over its political disarray and jeering at the claim that Britain will prosper outside the bloc because it makes some of the best products in the world. The best products? Cried the host.
British humour sein.
That must be the famous British sense of humour, he said. But largely unheard under all the derision over Britain's Brexit fiasco, some of Germany's top economists have been saying the Brits are not entirely to blame for the shambles. For example, for the failure to sign up to the withdrawal agreement.
It's understandable that the UK didn't want to sign up to this.
Professor Gabriel Felbermayr, head of the Kiel Institute for the World Economy in northern Germany.
You know, if I ask myself, what would a German parliament do? How would they decide? I would think they would have done the same thing.
It was coercive, he says, for the EU to impose a two-stage deal whereby the UK pays a $50 billion exit fee up front without a guaranteed free trade agreement with the bloc.
The UK would give away a lot of bargaining chips anyway. I mean, if we settle the financial bill, for example, if that is already given away, what is the clout of the UK in the second step?
Another top economist, Professor Marcel Fratscher, head of the DIW Institute in Berlin, also says it's understandable the Brits have rejected the withdrawal agreement.
Because it did not leave them a free choice about the permanent agreement between the European Union and the UK.
Fratscher, Felbermayr and a handful of other German economists believe that the EU should start afresh and adopt a more accommodating approach to Brexit. But Michael Wolgemuth of the Open Europe think tank says this is still a minority view in Germany. Most of the German people back the EU's hardline approach.
Some in Germany would even think that without the Brits, the European continent and its integration can go further and will be better served.
Should I stay or should I go?
But while that satirical TV show lampoons with this song British dithering over Brexit, there is a danger here for Germany. The UK is a major export market for German goods. A no-deal Brexit, says Anna Andrada of the Economist Intelligence Unit, could, along with the slowdown in China and other factors, hit the German economy.
If a lot of negative shocks take place, meaning a hard Brexit, if Donald Trump decides to increase tariffs on imported autos, then all of these could definitely bring the German economy into a recession.
The clock is ticking. Seid ihr raus!
And then Brexit might not prove quite so hilarious after all. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Shows off your arms, I guess.
Yeah, I just feel very comfortable wearing it. I mean, go vests.
Go vests. The bro vest. Straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. So as I said, U.S. exchanges closed today in observance of the Good Friday holiday for the four-day week that was. The Dow Industrials up 0.6%. The Nasdaq gained 0.2%. The S&P 500 down about 0.1% since Monday. Markets also shuttered in most of Europe, parts of Asia as well, although the Shanghai Composite Index rose 0.6%. In Tokyo, the Nikkei added about 0.5%. Everything's back to normal on Monday. On Wall Street, you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, it's Molly Wood here, and we've got a brand new episode of Make Me Smart that you should hear. This week, we're talking all about the gig economy IPOs. Lyft's gone public, Uber's filed their IPO, and Postmates isn't far behind. But with these companies relying so much on contract workers, what does that mean for the labor force?
The thing that we've got to do is make sure that, one, people still have the opportunity to use them as a source of economic mobility and a sort of launch point for other things, and two, that we don't end up with a permanent sort of professional class of workers versus service class of workers.
Make Me Smart. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One good way to get a sense of how this economy is working right now is to ask the people who are living and working and fishing in it every day. So we got Townsend Kaiser on the phone. He and his dad run Kaiser Family Farms down in Greensboro, Alabama, raising catfish mostly, but also some land-based animals as well. We spent some time down there with him a couple of three, maybe 4 years ago now. Townsend, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you again, Kai.
Let me ask you this first question, because it's been a good long while since we've had you on the program. How are things down in Greensboro? How's business?
Things are looking up. It's been a bad year and a half or so, but things are really looking up now.
How come it's been bad?
Well, we had a warm winter in 16 and 17 causing oversupply, and the price got pretty low. But we have worked through that supply, and it's kind of tightened up, and the price is easing back up a little.
Warm winters are good for catfish, I guess?
Well, they grow. You can keep feeding them as the water is warm, and we grew too many, and it just takes a while to work through that supply.
So when I was down there, it's got to be three, 4 years ago now, I remember driving around for like what seemed like hours around all those catfish ponds. Do you and your dad still have that much? It's not acreage, I guess. It's that many ponds going?
We still do.
And how do you decide, you know, when to farm them, when to not? I mean, how do you look at the market, I guess, is the question.
It's very difficult in the fish business because it takes so long to raise a crop from birth to processing is about 2.5 years. And so it's hard to manage inventories on the farm.
Yeah.
In the chicken business, they can break eggs and control inventory. We can't do that in the fish business.
When you look around, Townsend, at sort of the global economy and your place in it, what's on your mind? What are you worried about? Because, you know, elsewhere in trade policy news, there's tariffs and trade wars and all this jazz. Are you affected by that at all?
A little bit, but most of our fish are consumed in the South, and we are competing, obviously, with some of the imported fish from Vietnam, but we still have a lot of good, strong markets that like U.S. farm-raised catfish and enjoy that product, and I like supplying it.
Are you guys still doing that that fish fry up in Washington every year? Does that still happen?
We still do. Last few years, I think it's been in October, and all of the legislators and their staffers are always invited. We look forward to seeing them every year, and I think we're going back again this October.
Do you get good business done, or are you just feeding them? I mean, I guess the question is, what are the conversations about?
All kind of things, water and predation, and always about imported fish. And, you know, staffers come and go in Washington, so a lot of people get to eat it for the first time, and I enjoy being with them when they do.
Well, I'll tell you, I still remember that catfish you cooked up for us in your kitchen. That was kind of amazing.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Townsend Kaiser, he runs Kaiser Family Farms, him and his dad. How is your dad, by the way?
He's doing well. He's getting older, but he's doing well. All right. Enjoying life.
Good to talk to you, Townsend.
Take care, Kyle. You too.
Most of the fashion and style coverage we do on this program is of the higher end variety. Fashion Week in New York or maybe Paris, and how what shows on the runway eventually winds up cheaper, to be sure, on the racks at H&M or Uniqlo. Today, though, a story about fashion in finance and tech. Dress codes, never much of a thing in Silicon Valley, have really relaxed on Wall Street, too, and that's led to the rise of the vest. We're talking dudes here. Men, worn over business casual, often with a prominent company logo, they are becoming a big part of the way that a certain slice of this economy looks right now. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more from New York.
The vests we're talking about are usually fleece, or the puffy kind.
Well, they're very warm and comfy.
It just shows off your arms, I guess.
Yeah, I just feel very comfortable wearing it. I mean, go vests.
That's Simon LeCook, Don Correa, and Jason Adams. All three in finance, all three in fleece vests. It's lunchtime in Midtown, and vest-wearing dudes are everywhere, waiting near food trucks, picking up cold brew. Annalise Matsuo is eating lunch with a couple of vest guys herself, and finds the whole vest cult extremely amusing.
They just all walk in little rows together, like little ducklings, and they all look the exact same. I just think it's so cute and funny.
Years ago, it would have been something that you might see worn at Walmart by your greeter.
Susan Scafidi is founder of the Fashion Law Institute at Fordham Law School. She says the dress code in finance has gotten much more casual over the past few years, partly because expensive suits seemed garish after the financial crisis, and when Silicon Valley guys started showing up to meetings in jeans and hoodies, suits seemed a little embarrassing. Goldman Sachs acknowledged what it called the, quote, changing nature of workplaces in a recent decision to relax its dress code. Scafidi says the vest was also a way for companies to slap their logo on a casual piece of clothing and encourage a little camaraderie.
That spread from company to company until it became not only a branding of individual companies, but a branding of an industry.
The vest makes regular appearances in the HBO series Silicon Valley. An Instagram account featuring memes of vest bro culture has piled on 131,000 followers. The account is called Midtown Uniform.
There's something almost militaristic about it.
That's Kelly O'Coin, an actor in the Showtime TV series Billions. He plays a hedge fund trader named Bill Stern, who goes by Dollar Bill. A nod to his cheap wardrobe, almost always Dockers and a fleece vest, and a nod to the rush he gets out of making money.
I need those funds to flow like the Kankamangus Rapids. I'm ready to rock and roll on full auto right now.
Absolutely.
I think that the bald head and the fleece vest are actually Dollar Bill's source of power.
A power he wields a little too freely.
He has anger management issues. He manspreads like a champion.
This is not an image that some vest manufacturers want to be associated with. The North Face recently refused to fill an oil company's vest order, according to BuzzFeed. The clothing company Patagonia says it's going to focus on selling vests to, quote, mission-driven companies that prioritize the planet. Mark Cohen's a retail professor at the Columbia Business School.
So I can see them taking the view that there are companies out there they just don't want any association with.
Patagonia says its existing clients can keep ordering vests. And the demand for company vests isn't likely to go away anytime soon. Cohen says human beings simply like the affiliation.
Seems to be back in favor to show off the fact that you're a member of the firm.
And who knows, that kind of pride might even bring the three-piece suit back to Wall Street. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, no marketplace angle on this one, really, just a small slice of good news from Paris and Notre Dame. Seems there have been three beehives on the roof of the cathedral since 2013. They were feared lost in the fire this past Monday, but pictures taken since show the bees are alive and mostly well. Said the cathedral's beekeeper to the Associated Press, the carbon dioxide in the smoke basically makes bees drunk. I guess they don't have lungs. It then puts them to sleep, which, now that I think about it, is why you always see beekeepers using those smoke canisters. All right, we are out of here on this Friday afternoon. Markets will close today, open back up next Monday as usual. Our theme music composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you back here on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.